I had some moments where I felt like I was going to explode if I didn't get to play a certain thing that I heard, or I felt like so much desire, like a craving that, oh, I don't know what it is about this piece of music, but I have to play it or I have to listen to it 100 times.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. Multi-instrumentalist Colleen Allen is a versatile and expressive performer based in Toronto, Canada. In this conversation, we talked about her perspectives on evaluating priorities, rising to new challenges, collaboration, teaching improvisation, and the physical challenges of playing so many different instruments. Colleen's candid warmth and love of music really shine through in this wide-ranging conversation. The link for both the podcast and video is in the description, also linked to the transcript.
Hi, Colleen Allen. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Leah. Nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, I fell in love with Manteca, which I had never heard that band before I started researching Mark Ferguson. And then I found out about that. And I was asking him about you, and he said you should definitely try to get Colleen on the series. So I'm so glad you agreed.
Well, thank you. And Mark is a good friend and obviously, you know, a wonderful musician. And so thanks, Mark, for the connect.
And it's interesting because I think it's when people think of women in jazz, too often it's a vocalist, because I think that's the most common role that women play. Mm-hmm. And also, yeah, I think I want to talk about, of course, your career and everything, but I was thinking right away about mentorship and your role, you know, for other women as both a reed player and as a jazz musician. And if we could just start with that, like, did you have role models coming up through your education?
Well, I had a few and far between, and role models who probably weren't women, you know, like to have a female role model was very unusual. Catherine Moses was, she might have been the first woman saxophone player, flutist that I had seen in a performing setting playing jazz live. And she was playing with her band, I think it was at Jazz Festival, and I had seen her with Bruce Coburn. Mm-hmm. And it was just the coolest thing to see this woman walk on stage. And she's an instrumentalist, also a great singer, but primarily an instrumentalist in this band. And it was deeply meaningful for me. It made me feel like, you know, you can't be it if you can't see it. I hadn't thought of that before, because all of the saxophone players are men, especially in jazz, that I'd grown up with, all the music that I listened to and aspire to. And I never really thought about it being a woman. I just thought, okay, I want to be one of the guys so badly. And that was always what I aspire to, was just belonging. And then to see a woman on stage, Jane Fair as well, wonderful saxophone player from Montreal. And she's also a friend. Both of them I've become friends with. And Catherine, of course, passed away a year and a half ago. But she's left a legacy and so important for me. So, I mean, as in my role now as one of the elders in my community here in Toronto, I do think about mentoring. I've taught at Humber College in the Jazz Studies program for about 20 some odd years. I'm not there now. And I loved it. And I did. The courses that I taught an improv, first year improv class, performance classes, and there'd be many years where there were no women in the class. So I was the only one, and trying to, establish as an older female jazz musician, which the male students would not have seen much of, is to earn my cred. And to be able to get them on board that I have something to share and to offer to you, when it's like, well, how come I don't get to be in that guy's class or that guy's class, you know? So I just have to, you know, kick their butts from day one and earn my keep. And I did, you know, we always came to an agreement. But anyway, all of that to say that The next generation of musicians that are coming out of school and that I'm able to work with and are part of my colleagues, there's many more young, really good jazz improvising musicians. And on various instruments, not just on saxophone, there's some incredible ones. Tara Davidson, Allison Au, Allison Young, Rebecca Hennessy, Marie Gowdy on trumpet. Both of them are trumpet players. Elena Capillaris. So there's another generation. I think for me, it was Carrie Chestnut, Margot Davidson, and myself who were the sax players that were part of the community and try and find our way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Jane Bennett and her group Makeke, you've done some collaboration with them?
Yes. Well, I have, I can't believe I didn't mention Jane first, although she's closer to my age than Catherine. So I wouldn't have seen Jane, we sort of grew up, I would say she's a little bit older than me, but we would have grown up musically. She was sort of ahead of me in establishing her career. And I haven't played with Makeke. In fact, I opened for them at a concert in Burlington, and I've worked with members of the band, with Joanna Majoko, wonderful vocalist. And Jane is like a beacon of light, and for her too, especially as a specialist in Cuban music, she has carved a path of indelible path with through, I can only imagine, the kind of challenges that she would have had as a woman in Cuban studying and embracing and playing mm-hmm. music from Cuban traditions. So she's amazing, continues to be, and she sounds fantastic. So Jane, I'm sorry, you asked me about Jane, and then I realized that I hadn't talked about her yet. So what was your question about her again? Oh, a collaboration with Makeke.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had,
Well, our paths have crossed for sure. And Jane, and she's a friend, and we find each other on collective festivals from time to time. We don't often get to play together. I would love more of that.
And you had studied at Humber College and then later taught there. Did the school change or the way things were taught? Did that evolve?
Definitely. I'm only laughing because, I mean, it's probably not funny, but it's the whole world has changed. And I think jazz music might be the last bastion of embracing the positive changes from the Me Too movement about equity and diversity and just how we and school has become more codified. The jazz music was always taught, as you know, and your listeners probably well know, I mean, it was a mentorship. You hung out, you went to clubs, you got your ass kicked going to jam sessions, and you just tried to absorb through osmosis and through mentorship the music, the improvisation, the lifestyle, and the belonging. And those, that's going back into the original days of Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, of course, Miles Davis, back in 1940s and 1950s and 60s. The language has spread, has become more diverse, and there's less places to play. People are going to school because the best teachers are at school now. So you've got all the players that would have been doing all of that touring and playing six nights a week in different clubs and traveling are now part of great venerable jazz education schools like Berklee College, like Manhattan School, New School, North Texas, of course, and in Canada, Humber College, U of T, McGill, and others, but those at St. Evex, but those are the ones that sort of started the embracing it. So going to school and getting a jazz education degree, a degree in jazz studies or in performance studies is possible now, whereas it wasn't before. and the opportunities for education are there. So there are more students, there are more bodies studying, and I've sort of skipped over the Me Too part of it. You know, it was a very bro school, Humber for sure, U of T as well, where there were male teachers and you could say things and get away things that would be really distasteful or inappropriate now. And they were either impactful because that's how the language got passed on, or it was funny, or it was considered funny. And, you know, it's positive changes have happened in terms of the education through because of that, but also because of the way that jazz information is getting passed on now is through school. So there's more people, there's more oversight, there's more structure, I would say as well, in terms of the kind of courses that are offered. And then there's the courses that by the time students get to post-high school education, a lot of them have already had a really fantastic program in high school, or they may have studied in a community or a weekend program that was also being taught by really amazing jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess, you know, it's sort of one thing that it feeds from both sides of that, I think.
Now, I assume you started in a school band program.
I did. I went to, in Ottawa, actually. I went I went to Gloucester High School. Monsieur Taupin was our high school music teacher, and he was rigorous and a really interesting and wonderful teacher and inspired. There's a lot of us that went on in to have music as our careers. And I would say because of his rigor and balanced approach to teaching. So we improvised, we played in band, but there was also a strong classical training side of it and music history and connecting the dots between all those things. So he was a wonderful teacher and we were very lucky to have that. That would have been my gateway into, I started playing saxophone in high school, so that was the beginning of it. And then I felt like I knew that music, I found my people. Mm-hmm. When I was in band class or in musicals or that kind of setting, I had found my community. At that point, I wasn't sure what I was going to do with a music education, but I did decide. I went to Mohawk College for 2 years, and then I went to Humber College. And I was thinking, I come from a family of nurses, so I was thinking music therapy, some sort of healing side of the large umbrella of what a music education can, where it can lead. And then I started performing, and I was like, this feels pretty good, you know, and being on stage and playing, performing, creating, that really spoke to me. So and I started having opportunities in that area, so I just followed through on that.
Before we leave the Humber and the whole education thing, there's a couple things you said that struck me. You used the expression getting your ass kicked in the context of jam sessions, both and also teaching. So is that because it's intimidating and hard when you're first improvising and you're not quite at the level, or is there something more going on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it for sure it's a striving art form. You never arrive. You know, probably say that about many things. Getting your ass kicked, meaning being challenged on what you don't know, and finding and that's, you know, there's other ways to motivate, I think, to be able to do the work. There's no free ride. So, you know, showing up at school and being able to, a lot of the time for guitar players, they, you know, rhythm section players tend to show up with a lot more playing experience because they're jamming instruments. So they would be playing together in somebody's basement in high school. Mm-hmm. And that was part of their social life. As horn players, that isn't as common. You know, it's not a campfire. Saxophone's not a campfire kind of instrument. You know, mm-hmm. we kind of need to play together. And certainly for me, there were no places outside of high school that that happens. So by the time students get to a first year improv class, you might have a guitar player who can shred in E minor, but not be able to read very well. Won't have had the opportunity to learn that aspect of their instrument, or playing in different keys, or being able to do different voicings. Whereas, you know, a drummer, like everybody arrives with something to learn. That's why they're going to school. And sometimes, you know, the motivation is, you can talk it, you can show it, you can, but at a certain point you got to do the work. So the ass kicking part of it is like, okay, next week we got to do these tunes. So get them together or don't, but this, we're moving on to other stuff. So, you know, whatever, you know, for me, that's, I guess I'm using ass kicking because that's probably what I grew up with. Yeah. Have you seen Whiplash? Did you see that film?
Do you know the film?
Oh, okay. As an improvising musician, the context of this is that Whiplash, there's a really badass old school guy teacher, and there's a drummer who's aspiring to play in this band, in this big band, and he's not cutting it. And eventually chairs get thrown and screaming and yelling, and that's the ass kicking, that's the motivation. It's interesting. And I imagine as a non-musician, you get, like, we all know what that felt like, because we were in those circumstances, certainly in the earlier days of imparting information. But there's no connection to the emotional, like, why would you want to do, like, what's the emotional, spiritual or emotional connection to the music that's also a driving force? Is like, this makes me feel something, or the end of this is going to be, I'm going to move an audience. This is going to be expressive. This is, you know, and that, I found was lacking in Whiplash. It's an entertaining film though.
With your first year improv students, when you're teaching them, did you use blues as a springboard? Was it?
I did it at first because it felt like it's a simpler kind of harmonic form. It's a simpler 12 bar, or, you know, usually a very basic form, 12 bar form. It's repetitive, and so I used to, but I found that it was limiting, and because the same things that make it easy also make it hard to move on to other things, because it's easy to default to a typical blues scale sound. But I found that what I gravitated towards was thinking more of melodic improvisation. So even taking familiar, like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star or something, like a melody, and just trying to create a melody over even the first five notes of a major scale or pentatonic major sound, and to just try and create a connection to melodic improvisation as opposed to learning your scales and being able to shred them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was feeling a malaise in terms of how I was teaching, because I felt like I can hear you're going for this thing, but we're not connecting again on that emotional level. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, especially because I had vocalists in my class as well. And so it was, you know, usually there'd be three or four singers, three or four horn players, three or four bass drum, like three of or so of every instrument. And so to try and find a way of threading and creating, I don't know, I guess a connection seems to be the word that's coming to mind. So I just started, we would just improvise sometimes, like just, okay, I'm just going to start playing and then I'm going to pass it over to you. And it's sort of like telephone, and it doesn't matter what you play. But maybe like, and you know, we're having a conversation right now, and in terms of our conversation, we're connecting to an idea. So I would play something and say to the next player, bass player, let's say, You can play whatever you want, but maybe if you think of it as a conversation, maybe you're going to pick up on a rhythm that I've just played or a note that I've just played or ba-da-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da, and then use that as a starting point for your improvisation, which can go anywhere and pass. So different ways of doing it, but the idea that I guess what it came down to, and I had this epiphanal moment in a class where I realized, and this was not in an improv class, but it's so appropriate for that. I realized that really what we're doing is learning how to listen to each other. And that's by bringing things down to a lower common denominator, eliminating some of the technical stuff, and then we're going to play this scale over that chord, and we're going to do this and that. I just took away a lot of the information and said, just listen. Let's just try starting with listening. And I'm not sure. I mean, the response in the class for me was really good. I think I felt better about, and eventually you have, you got to learn how to all of that technical stuff is going to enable more facility as an improviser, but you got to start with something that means something. And it's the best feeling in the world to be playing with people and you play something and they play back to you. Or it's like, oh my God, you're listening to me. You're hearing what I'm saying. And I thought that was, I didn't like what I played, but you played it back to me. I thought it sounded great, so I'm going to play it again, or whatever the response is. But it's so respectful to be listened to. So we have to learn how to listen, and that's what the common denominator ended up being for me.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm an independent podcaster who does all the many jobs required to produce the series, and there are a lot of costs I bear as well. Please consider either buying me a virtual coffee as a tip or becoming a monthly supporter starting at $3 Canadian, which is close to $2 US or 2 euros, and getting access to unique perks. The link is in the description. Now back to the episode.
I'd mentioned the blues, and actually, you've had a long association with the Toronto Blues Society Women's Review.
Yes. So the Women's Blues Review, I might be the longest standing member of the show, and I think they, I don't even know how many years it's been going on. Maybe 30 something. And I've missed a couple. And I don't think I was at the very first one, but I've done most of them, let's say. I've been lucky enough to be a part of the group. And it's a really great celebration of blues, like it just as, as large as the umbrella of jazz is, incorporating so many different styles. Blues, similarly, there's many different styles of blues, and then of course jazz and blues are also connected. And this is a celebration of all of that, including original material, more soul, R&B kind of blues, traditional Delta Chicago blues, depending on who the artists are. So, yeah, the show's evolved since I first started. There were Evelyn Daddle was the music director. She's a great composer, pianist in Toronto. And there were some other, let's see, who else? The horn section, Sarah McAlcrin, Carrie Chestnut, myself. And over it was all, and then there were men that were playing the roles of that women had not been able to take over yet, and it was often came down to the drums. Bucky Berger was our drummer for many years, and now there's enough women who are play that it's an all-women band. It has been for quite a few years now, and we've evolved to that, and that's super exciting. Any specific things about
Well, I
that?
was just looking up the larger umbrella organization, kind of curious why is there this Toronto Blues Society, and I guess it was a response to the disco era and blues clubs were starting to close down, and there was a concern that we're going to lose this music. And it's funny to think back of what was going on in popular music at the time.
That's so, yeah, I guess. I mean, I was right there when that was happening. And I remember again, that word malaise. I remember feeling slightly embarrassed that I grew up in the disco era, but there was so much great music that happened. When I look back on it now, for me, the high school years were in the 1970s. it was a fantastic time to be growing up as a musician. Yep, there was a lot going on. But yeah, the Blues Society, I mean, it's great. And the Women's Blues Review is a big fundraiser for them. It's really well attended. We started it at the Horseshoe Tavern in Toronto, and then graduated to the Diamond Club, and then the Danforth Music Hall, and then Massey Hall. We're now a Massey Hall show, and we get close to, if not sold out, every year. And people, it's a really well-supported show and showcase. There's a house band, and then there's six artists that are performing every year. There's a different group of artists that perform.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's lots, and it's great.
So when did you start playing the flute? Because you do play so many different instruments.
Through playing jazz music, if you're playing in a big band, a saxophone player in a big band, you're expected that you're going to be able to play flute and clarinet. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I started when I was in college. The woodwind parts in big band music, particularly if you're playing something like Toshiko Akiyoshi, the woodwind parts are not commensurate with the level of skill of the woodwind players if they start on saxophone. It's expected that you can do it, and I mean, it's a big challenge for us saxophone players to really authentically play flute and clarinet and clarinets. So at that young age, still sort of figuring out being a good saxophone player. So it was, you know, I remember hyperventilating quite a bit playing the flute, and then the clarinet, the mystery of the clarinet, and trying to, I became really good at playing specific parts on the flute and on the clarinet, mm-hmm. Out of necessity. And then I loved them so much. I started studying more seriously on all the instruments. So yeah, but it's, you know, it's a lifelong, commitment.
Ergonomically, Colleen, have you had challenges like some of the big heavier instruments? Like I imagine neck straps help, but like with, you know, the weight on your hands?
Oh yeah, excellent question. Yeah, I've had to work at that from different angles. So I actually have my neck strap on now. This one is it's called a neck strap, but it doesn't touch my neck at all. It's got this claws on the back, that, and then there's a stomach brace, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's fairly light, and it keeps the weight off my neck. I have another strap that I use that's like an exoskeleton strap for when I'm playing Barry. Mm-hmm. I can use it on this strap, but I get to use a bit more of my body. It's ergonomically more efficient with my frame for Barry sax. But also, I had to start doing a big commitment to my physical health, and to be able to not hurt my hands, my upper body, my back. So I start my day doing yoga, and I bike ride everywhere just to get enough cardio, breathing and cardio going. And it's an ongoing process to stay healthy, to be able to continue to play.
Do you find you have to do more strength training as you get older?
Yes, absolutely. Weight training and upper body strength, it sounds so, it's something I never considered before, but just being able to lift instruments up and put them in the back of my car, you know, baritone, bass clarinet, all the gear. So, and that kind of movement is unconscious movement. In a way, it's like, oh, I'm lifting, I'm pulling. So the more that I do conscious exercise, the more that I'm able to just facilitate what I need to get from there to there with all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I also have a nice little, I should send you a little photograph. I have a cart, a little U-line cart that where I live in Toronto is close enough for me to walk to where they have the jazz festival now in town. So I had three gigs in a row, and I was playing baritone and bass clarinet for the first gig, tenor flute, soprano, and clarinet on the second one, and then I was playing alto and flute on the third one. So I had all of these instruments in my U-line cart, and I just walked over with it, and it was good. I felt by the time I got there, I had my oxygen was going, and it seems a bit like my dad used to say, the saying, like, it's a bit much, and it's a bit much, but it's also when I'm there and I'm playing those instruments, I'm like, this is perfect. I love this. This is what I want to be doing. So,
Well, you'll be sharing a video that we'll edit in of you demonstrating some of your instruments. But you also offered you might be able to just play a solo for us, maybe on your, is it your alto or
yeah,
your tenor?
I've got my alto handy. I
Is
could
that
do that.
your favorite range?
I started on tenor, and then I started playing flute and clarinet, and then I played alto, and they all have meaning for me. Like, they're all quite special, but I guess I probably know more tunes on alto, and it's easier to carry on my bike. And it's the one that I have out. So yeah, it's, and I have a good read, whoever's got a good read going is my favorite. All right, so I'll just play a tune for you.
Lovely, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. That was If I Were a Bell.
I love your tone and your nuance when you play. I think I had some bad early experiences with sax players, playing in like high school band. And then when I went to McGill University, there was this one super echoey practice room that wasn't, it didn't have any like sound insulation. And the jazz sax players loved to practice in there. And sometimes I'd be stuck with my violin next to them trying to hear myself. And they'd be shredding,
Oh, as one does. Yes, I know. Oh, I that's I on behalf of all of us, I apologize.
Is it a challenge playing transposing instruments in big band, like having to think differently?
Well, I don't have perfect pitch. Do you have perfect pitch?
No.
Or perfect relative pitch, probably. So I don't have perfect pitch. So the fact that I'm in a different key than the concert instrument is not an issue. And the music's in a big band, it's all transposed for
Okay.
us. However, I have acquired transposition skills. And so if I'm looking at a lead sheet or like a piano lead sheet, I can transpose for alto or for, I could E flat or B flat instruments, no problem. It's just one of our tools in our toolkit. I think we're sort of expected.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it just means that I have options if I'm, if it's somebody's original music and I feel like maybe I want to play alto, maybe soprano. I don't know what I'm going to play on this. It's nice to have concert pitch.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Yeah, but if I'm looking at a scored part or something like that, it's usually transposed. Okay, so I thought it might be kind of fun to share a video with you of, as I said, my dad said it's a bit much. I've been playing with Manteca, and on this particular recording, I have nine different instruments that I'm playing, and so this video will give you an example of some of those instruments. But I'm surrounded by them, and I called my music station the pawn shop because there's also an accordion in there, which I do play a little bit. Yeah, so this is Manteca and me playing a bunch of different instruments.
Thank you, Colleen. I really am a big fan of Manteca, and actually, Matt Zimbel will be featured on the series coming
Oh,
up soon.
great. Okay, well, he's the one that's going to give permission for me to play the video.
I was watching the movie he made last night about his dad. Have you seen it?
I have seen it. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, really beautiful.
Yeah. And Matt is a very special person, and his two brothers too. Very creative family, and his dad is an interesting man, and had a fantastic career. So, and the film is beautifully done.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
You had mentioned the accordion. I was going to ask you about that because, as a reed player, I was wondering if you played piano, but then I remembered you played accordion. So, has that helped you in terms of writing music and arranging to have more of a harmonic knowledge?
Well, I did start out as a piano player,
Okay.
and so I do have, I mean, I'm not a, you know, I just, it's functional for me now. It's great for arranging, for writing, but I don't consider myself a pianist whatsoever. However, I do have the enough training on the instrument. And it's sort of the accordion. It started off as a wannabe in the rhythm section feeling. And in fact, I think the first time I ever played one in performance might have been in the Women's Blues Review. And it was just sort of inappropriate. It might have been in one of the recordings. There was some accordions. So my friend Sarah did it first. And then I tried it and really liked it. And I wouldn't consider myself an accordionist, but it's a color that I can use, and it breathes like a wind instrument, and I have enough keyboard facility that I can play it and connect to the breathing. So it's not a stretch really to think about playing. And most people have enough piano playing that they can play simpler. It's just I think of it more as texture and color, and it's part of the sound palette. I did do a theater show that I actually had to walk out on stage and play accordion and get the left hand and right hand going, which is, requires a bit of coordination. And that might have been one of the more terrifying things I've ever had to do is to, I'm the only source of music. I'm walking across the stage and I'm having to play this instrument that is, it's fairly new to me. But what I realized, I watched the actors every night before the show. They'd come and they'd rehearse their collective lines and parts together. And I figured I just need to rehearse the walking with the accordion. And once I did that, I got the you know, I knew when I needed to move and when I was going to turn. And so I learned from the actors on how to be a better accordion actor.
I once was asking a theater actress how she memorized her lines. And she said for her, it was very physical, that every line, every section had a physical motion associated with it in her body, in her mind. Mm-hmm. And I'm always curious, talking to jazz musicians, how you guys remember the names of tunes, you know, how you memorize so many chord progressions that are kind of similar. How's that worked for you?
I guess it's repetition, but I've gotten smarter and faster about that. Plus I probably have some, you know, pretty good neural pathways for doing it for so long. But I remember, I think it's different learning tunes and repertoire, and as opposed to learning material. So memorizing, for instance, the one thing that I had to memorize that was the most astounding amount of information was the first gig that I did with Matt Tekka.
Okay.
And Matt said, no music stands. You have to memorize it. And Kelly Jefferson and I were, this when the band just started up again after their hiatus, and John Johnson wasn't able to do the show, so I was subbing for him. And I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to do repetition. I'm going to play it over and over and over again. And like, these are all parts. It's not like there's necessarily a melody. It's internal parts, and a lot of them, because we're the singers. There's no singer in the band. The horns are the singers. Mm. And what I realized from doing it was that I was taking a mental image. I could actually write out the parts because I memorized what it looked like. I knew at the bottom of page 2 there was a line that was leading to the top of page 3, and then there was 4 bar. Like, I could actually visualize a chart, which was shocking to me because I never thought of myself as a visual learner until that moment. And so I think that the learning repertoire is oral. Sometimes it's a chart, but for me, if I'm learning standards, I'm looking at a concert piece of music. So and concert changes that I'm transposing in my head. So I think I take it in more orally. Mm-hmm. And repetition and playing along with recordings. And, you know, it's a bit more forgiving than playing a perfect execution of you can get away with more nuance and interpretation. But it was funny when we got to the gig, it was Kelly and I, we did it, and it was a lot of repertoire, but the trumpet player showed up to the first rehearsal in the gig, and he had a music stand and all the charts. I'm like, dude, I thought we were supposed to memorize this. And he said, well, they're up there, you know, jingling and jangling and da-da-da, and I'm going to be looking at my effing charts. So I thought, you mean you could actually say that? I didn't have to memorize, but I was glad that I did. It was really good for me. It was very challenging. And I think I created, again, those neural pathways that hadn't been created before. But how about you? How do you memorize repertoire?
I don't. I'm an orchestral player. And I, you know, as a student, we had to memorize things. And it was always challenging. And someone had asked me, oh, yeah, Micah Sudri, a jazz drummer, his episode will be up before yours. He'd said, you know, you must know so much repertoire by heart as a violinist. I said, well, soloists do, but I don't.
Right.
And actually, many years ago, I was asked to play, it was like part of a Mozart opera, and it was like, you don't have to play the whole opera if your string quartet will play this little bit that's kind of on stage and you have to be in costume, so it seemed like a great deal. But then they said, we really would like you to memorize it. But I said, there's absolutely no way, like, I'm not going to deal with those nerves. And actually, what I remember, we had to climb up, you know, it's sort of what you said about going on stage. We were wearing these wigs and tons of makeup, and it was very high up. And I remember I was scared of the height. And it was a simple part, but if I'd had to worry about memorizing it would have been a whole other layer of difficulty for me.
Well, and I think that you touched on a really important thing, which is the nerves. And it is one thing to have to internalize it, to feel comfortable with it. But then it's, you know, a bunch of performances would probably back off the nerves, and it's dealing with the nerves. That's huge, huge.
Yeah.
part piece of it, usually more than the music often. How do you deal with do you ever get nervous or anxious before you perform? You play with the same people probably most of the time, but
I always do get nervous, and actually on my YouTube channel, I've sort of done a mini talk about nerves because I've been dealing with it my whole life and things that have helped me. But I think one thing that helped was realizing that some of the chemicals you're getting, because we were taught about fight or flight, it's sort of that's, but how can I summarize this briefly? So what I was learning pretty recently, actually, is that a lot of that research was done by basically torturing animals, 50 years ago, and they came up with this this conclusion that that's what happens when people are scared. But they were terrifying these animals, and then they looked at what happened to their bodies. And but actually, often when we're under stress because of nerves, it's not the fight or flight. It's actually a challenge state, which is a very positive state, but you feel some of the same things. You this heightened awareness, your heart might race. So, but this can help you perform well. And it's more complicated than that, but I'll just say that just that one realization has been one thing that's helped me. But when we're nervous, I would think it would affect reed players too. I think as descending from apes, we have a tendency to grasp, and as a violinist, it's the worst thing you can do is grab your bow, your violin too tightly. And I think a lot of us are aware that will start to happen when you're very nervous or even a little bit nervous, as opposed to the practice room where things are just flowing beautifully. Has that affected you, that sort of grabbing feeling?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Again, the physical work that I'm doing now to stay in good physical shape is also mind body, and to try and eliminate, because it's not helpful. Like it doesn't help performance. It hinders, and so it's a very conscious work to try and breathe. I play a breathing instrument, so to keep the air going, keep the breath going.
But actually, one thing I'm curious about, because wind players almost always breathe through their mouths in order to get a lot of air very quickly, but that can sort of lead to more anxiety, from what I understand. If on a daily basis you're breathing through your mouth, it's because it's more of an anxiety situation or emergency as opposed to breathing through your nose. Have you run across that or thought about it?
I haven't thought about it other than in the context of I have a couple of friends who talk about nose breathing, and as an alternative to using asthma medication, they have done some training, and I've done some long drives on a tour, whatever, and had long conversations about this. So it makes sense to me, and I do try and breathe through my nose. Certainly in meditative kind of, when I'm consciously thinking about it, I'm nose breathing, as I am right now.
We talked a little bit about arranging. Now you have the saxophone quartet as well. Have you written a lot of arrangements for them?
That was one of the things that I started doing during COVID. Was just having the time for it. It's a high maintenance, choice I've made to play all these different instruments, and they require a lot of work. So to be able to spend that time during COVID, I was curious about the sound. I was just running. I hadn't thought about doing it because I just love playing in the quartet, and we have tons of great repertoire, but I thought it would be fun to try and do a couple sax quartets, and then I recorded them with me playing all of the parts. So it was fun to write the arrangements and then to do the demos. It was great fun. And that led to, in fact, that led to another project. I work with a singer named Molly Johnson, a jazz singer, and she was doing last year at this time, she was doing a new Christmas record for her, and she asked me to arrange one of the tunes. And was it Julie London? I can't remember who the singer was. Anyway, it's a sweet, sweet tune. Winter's Got Spring Up Its Sleeve is the name of the song. And she said, I want you to arrange this, and I want you to make it fluty. And I'm like, oh, Flutie. Okay, so that was the direction for this arrangement. And anyway, so I did, and I did it for five woodwinds. So two C flutes, one alto flute, two clarinets, and bass clarinet. And I figured the three flute, or no, one clarinet and bass clarinet. So there were five, and there'd be enough flutes to make it sound fluty. And that was great. So I was it was a big high bar challenge in the sense that I was doing it. I played all the parts so I could hear what it would sound like, and then we went in the studio and recorded it with three woodwind players. I played the first flute part, and then there was another player who played second flute and clarinet, and then the alto flute and the bass clarinet player doubled those parts. Anyway, it was really fun to get to stretch that muscle, and I really like it. I would love to spend more time arranging and writing, and that's the one thing that, there's lots of challenges during COVID, but that was one of the things that I had the time and I was able to spend it doing a lot of work, which was great.
I discovered Molly Johnson singing through researching yourself, and I really, she's such an incredible, expressive singer. What have you learned? Because you've worked with her a lot. What have you learned in terms of music making from her?
Well, Molly is a really interesting artist. She's got an iconic voice, and she calls herself a lazy singer because she doesn't warm up, and she's very casual about it. However, she studied at the National Ballet School for maybe 10 years. I don't know, 8 or 10 years. She was there with Veronica Tennant, and she was being groomed to be Canada's first prima ballerina of color. And she had the skills and she was being groomed for that, but she started singing and she's like, this feels better to me. This makes more sense. So anyway, all of that to say she's had rigorous training in performance, and I know that that's played a role in her ability to walk out on stage and be able to be in performance mode. So I've learned that. And I've also, one of the things I love about Molly is that she surrounds herself with great musicians, but also people that she feels very connected to. And it's like her family. She needs to feel really surrounded by, and I'm sure, I mean, it's a tough life being out on the road and traveling, and you want to be able to have a nice hang with the people that you're traveling with. So I've learned about, surround yourself with excellence, but make sure that it's people that you can sit on a bus with or on a plane or get lost, get stuck in an airport and still be able to talk to each other. So, yeah. And just, general badassiness. Molly's she's been through, she was a child actor too, so she's been in the business her whole life, and she's a no BS kind of person, and she's got a thick skin. So I might have learned a bit of that from her too. And a little bit of potty mouth too.
Do you have advice for younger musicians about touring, how to tour well, take care of yourself and
I don't know. I think you have to just go and figure it out. I think to me, the most challenging thing, and it wasn't as bad when I was younger, is just being able to take your instruments and play your own instruments and being able to travel with them. I don't know. I figured out a lot of stuff. You just have to go. Just go. Say yes. That would be my advice. Just say yes and you'll figure it out. Most of the young people that I know are way better at tuning into their bodies and taking better care of themselves than we ever were. I respect my young colleagues. I've learned lots from them, and I think that they're amazing. And I'm happy that everybody's being able to get out there and go back out on the road. I don't do a lot of traveling now for music. You know, a little bit. I've gone out a few times this year. It's always great fun. It's just taking your instruments on planes is really a drag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you find the jazz scene is bouncing back coming out of the lockdowns?
Yes.
In Toronto?
Yeah, totally. There's a few places that have closed. Mm. And there's more places that are opening, and people are supporting clubs, as far as I can tell. And again, you know, younger players are creating places for them to play. It's so essential in terms of growing as a musician, is being able to be playing with other players and in front of people, where there's more at stake. It's a performance. You need to have more together and more experience doing that. So I feel quite optimistic about, you know, in terms of what are people getting paid to do that? What, you know, most younger players that I know, I mean, there's a lot have other jobs. We did too when we were younger, but there seems to be, as there was when I was growing up, there's a really thriving corporate and wedding scene, and people are getting paid well to do that, as they should. And if that enables you to do your creative work, then great. You're playing music and you're playing with people, probably really good musicians, and that, mm-hmm. that feels good too.
You had done some Cirque du Soleil shows.
I did. I went to Germany and lived there for a year doing a show with Cirque du Soleil called Pomp, Duck, and Circumstance. And it was sort of an unusual Cirque show in that it was a pairing with a German chef. Most of the Cirque shows are in a tent, and in a like theatrical performance in a tent. This was also in a tent, but a smaller one, those vaudevillian mirror tents all the way around the side, red velvet. And people would come and have dinner, and there would be animation happening while they were having dinner. And then there'd be four main acts that would happen throughout the evening. Mm. And it was very, very cool. Great idea. And very like life transforming experience for me to go and live in another country and work with other musicians. And the band was a band made up of people from all over the world, and it didn't necessarily work that well right away. It took a while for us to find our common language, and then working with circus performers. Wow. And high performance athletes. And all of us navigating this experience together, was so grateful I had the chance to do that.
Would you have to alter the timing of anything, or was it sort of set? It all worked in terms of the charts.
There was some scripted music, and then we could play whatever we wanted. And we were all jazz musicians, for the most part, improvisers. Mm-hmm. So it was really, it was fun, you know, learning a lot of repertoire. And that I did do, ended up doing a lot of work on my flute and my clarinet there too, because I had the opportunity to. And the German musicians, violinist was from Germany, pianist living in New York, but he's from Germany, and they all had very serious classical training. So there was lots of, you know, musicianship that was happening. And and we got to play music that was challenging, and audiences liked it. So we could, you know, as long as we were playing music, that they didn't seem to mind what we were playing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to hear, I think, maybe three Cirque shows live in Ottawa over the years. And the music was always really, really high level.
They have scores that are written for specific shows. And mm-hmm. it's completely integral. It's not an afterthought ever. It's an integral piece of what the tone or the theme or whatever the each specific show is. And I mean, it's just one of the things that they've, one element of it that they've done really well. And usually it wasn't the case in this show, but usually the musicians are on stage or in close to on stage, or they're in costume or something, like they're embedded in the show. We were embedded in the show, but we were also like a small big band. So we were wearing suits and had music stands. Like we were, you know, it was like we were a band on stage like a, you know, a Frank Sinatra kind of setting. So we backed up the performers, but we also played when, you know, behind the scenes as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was great. And it was really, really cool to get to be a part of a Cirque experience. It's changed. This was quite a long time ago, but just to watch the level of rigor in terms of watching athletes and how they prepare and train for shows and how safety is taken into consideration, but that you'd never know it. Like, everything is very relaxed and casual, but their safety is paramount. Attention to detail, all of that was really cool. And then we lived in Hamburg I lived in Hamburg. The show continued on after that, but I came back to Canada mm-hmm. after a year. And Hamburg is a gorgeous city, and it was just what a wonderful, like, I mean, this is the thing about being a musician, is just being able to have these experiences that I would never have had the chance to do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I lived a life there for a year, let's just say, and it was good.
Yeah. Now, you've been part of lots of, you know, bigger bands like Manteca we were talking about, but your solo CDs with a small ensemble, I really love them. I've listened to them a lot.
Thank you.
And maybe if you want to talk to them and, you know, is it Torchlight, the second one? Flashlight.
Oh, Flashlight, yeah.
Yeah.
I have the privilege of working with a lot of great bands and people. And you know, I've just, at a certain point, I've just sort of had enough songs that I felt like I really wanted to do something with them. So I've done two recordings of my own, and I've got enough material probably to do another one. It's just, I'm just trying to decide how I want to do that, because, you know, it's not like people, I barely listen to CDs now. I have an external CD player if I have to input any music. I mean, we can access it in so many other ways. So I'm just trying to think about how and why I would do another recording. But the first two, you know, I raised the bar on myself by having to take on the production side of it, organizing the musicians and, you know, saving the money to be able to do it. And so every time I've done it, I've grown as a musician. And the first one, Mark Jordan, great singer, Mark Jordan, sang on one of my tunes, which is unexpected. I asked, my husband, Stephen McKinnon, and Mark write together. And I asked Mark and Stephen if they mind if I do this song. And Mark said, well, do you want me to sing it? I'm like, sure, I want you to sing it. Then I'll just, you know, I'll play saxophone solo, you can be the singer. So that's the one vocal tune. The rest of them are all instrumental, and a couple of my tunes, and they're all my arrangements. And then on the second recording, this is the Flashlight recording, it's all standards. I had heard Wayne Shorter talking about a Flashlight, always having a flashlight so you can see where you've come from as well as where you're going to. And so this is sort of my homage to some tunes that I've been playing, and I did some arrangements of them. And so it was not original music, just original arrangements of. And again, it was a huge learning curve to start and finish something.
So for your next project, are there things you would do differently to make it easier?
I don't know if there's any way to make it easier. I think it's just the process, is just being in the process of it. I think, I don't know, this doesn't, it probably makes it harder because I have to think about what I'm wearing, but I would do video. I would probably record it live in studio for the recording part of it, but also for the video capture, because that would be almost more important than having the recording, is having the video now. So that might be the biggest change for me, is just thinking about it having to be. So then now I'm thinking about setting as opposed to, you know, thinking about what it's going to look like as much as what it's going mm-hmm. to sound like.
I was also wondering, especially as an improvising musician, I really do enjoy live recordings of jazz that are out there, if you've just considered just doing a show and for a couple of shows and just recording.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think it would be great to be able to book 3 nights somewhere and record 3 nights and then just use the best of that. So, and I too like being in a live performing setting and as an improviser, there's just something about knowing that it's that moment and that's all. And some of my favorite recordings are live recordings as well. I find for me, it's just more pressure if it's not live to get it right or perfect. And that just doesn't happen as an improviser ever. You know, if I could be left in the, do you want to take another, you know, another take? And I would always say yes, because it's like, well, maybe it's not there yet, or maybe, you know. So there's something about a live performance, and that's it. It's captured. So, yeah. And that's comfortable for me. I've done, you know, I'm a live performer. So that's a comfortable setting for me.
My husband and I acquired just this randomly. Someone was getting rid of some records, and it was, I think, a pristine LP of Louis Armstrong live recording in Italy shortly after the Second World War when he was touring Europe. And you can hear the crowd, and there's this crackle in the air, and it's a phenomenal recording.
Yeah. Well, that's, and you know, just think about that one. How many live performances did he ever do? And that was one moment, and it sparkles, you know, and it crackles, and it just makes it that much more special too, doesn't it?
And thinking about the roots of jazz, I was just thinking about Sidney. Is it pronounced Bechet? Because we had an old LP of his that I listened to growing up, and that was kind of in my ear as this very different kind of saxophone sound, very vibrated, and obviously that changed over time. And I wanted to ask you about vibrato, because in the jazz violin world, there's this, you know, idea, well, you shouldn't vibrate, or it should be used very differently in modern jazz violin playing. How is it for reed players?
Well, it's evolved like any of the language has evolved, you know. And when you think about Sidney Bechet, he was playing soprano saxophone, so smaller mouthpiece, and very fast vibrato. And the horn players were imitating the singers at that time. So, you know, like that sort of vibrato, but they were there. That's where that fast vibrato came. And then in the sax section, everybody would be playing in the 1930s, the dance bands, they were all playing with very fast vibrato. And then as the instruments became solo instruments and voice changed and interpretation and stuff, the vibrato has changed as well. And I mean, so as it is, you know, on violin for sure, it's an emotional addition to a phrase or a line. It's a tool of phrasing, and so, it's very personal, too. And so I hear some singers now that have a very fast vibrato still, not as many, and then there's some that use no vibrato, and you know, in particularly like in a Brazilian style singing, and it's so effective and appropriate for that. So yes, for sure, vibrato has changed and evolved and continues to be a personal tool of expression, I think.
Yeah. I'm always interested in sort of geeky aspects.
I love that. It was a great question.
You'd mentioned the challenges of the pandemic and that you'd started having time to do arrangements. And certainly all of us, you know, learned a lot. At the beginning of this call, we had some technical problems, which we quickly fixed. But I was saying to you, it had been so long since I'd had any technical problems. It was a bit of a shock. But at the beginning, I mean, when all this happened in 2020, most of us hadn't ever been on Zoom or done a live stream. But I know a lot of your family lives far away. Were they able to tune into some shows you were doing or recordings because of that happening?
Well, thanks to Adrian Cho
Yeah.
at Sync Space. Yes, as a matter of fact, and our bass player. That this these are sessions that I did with Mark Ferguson. Our bass player's family lives on the West Coast as well as my family, so it was so much fun to be able to do those shows and to be able to. Just, have our fam. It's not very often that they get to hear me play, certainly in a performance setting. So that was very, very special. And I think that it's also, it ignited or inspired a lot of us to get our home systems together and to be able to do more live recording. And I'm recording something this afternoon to send to a friend who's going to put it on his track for, it's like we're set up to do it. I mean, I do have live-in tech support, which I don't take for granted. I think we've all embraced it now, and that maybe that's another one of the benefits of how we spent our time is figuring out this, some of the technology.
Yeah, I actually I talked to Diane Nalini, Adrian's wife, is featured on the series, and that was the first interview I actually recorded over the platform we're using right now, Riverside, which enable where you record each side separately. And anyway, we discussed SyncSpace quite a lot on there. But for people who haven't heard that episode yet, Adrian Cho developed this platform where musicians can play in real time together without much of a lag at all. So when you were performing with Mark, he was in Ottawa and you were in Toronto, just
Yes.
500 kilometers apart, in real time with people listening, as opposed to most videos people see online where it looks like people are playing together, but of course it's done separately. And some audience members don't realize that. They think people are actually playing together when those videos are made.
Right. Yeah, and that was it was very interesting for us non-orchestral players. So we had a drummer from Toronto, a bass player in Toronto, and we were in our separate homes. And then Mark in Ottawa. And Adrian sort of described, because there's a little bit of a lag, but not it's significant enough to make it not work. But he said it's sort of like you're either 6 feet away from somebody in an orchestra, or maybe you're 12 feet away from the violin section, and or you're behind a gobla or whatever. And to be able to navigate what that is like in an orchestra. And to, so there's a certain level of just sort of, again, it's the listening. You're listening and adapting. And it was, yeah, it's been fun. Every time we've done it, I've really enjoyed the, I don't get to play with Mark very often, and he's a special guy, and it's just so much fun to be able to do that together.
Have you done much teaching online?
No, I have not. In fact, I finished my, so 2020, I finished the school year online like everybody did. And then I stopped teaching after that. And so I guess you're teaching online, are you?
I don't now. I just, if there's people studying with me who aren't in Ottawa, which is more occasional, I will teach them online. So I've developed lots of ways to do it. But I taught online for a very long time, like at least a year or something.
Yeah, I it felt for me in terms of my role as a teacher, I feel like it just felt like the opportunity to step back was there, and that I've got some young colleagues who are very capable and looking for an opportunity to do that. I felt like it was a good time for me to step back from teaching and let them take over, and now I've got more time to, it's all about me now.
That's good.
I feel like I've done my service, and I loved and I learned so much teaching. And yeah, now I feel like I'm have other things, pursuits, musical pursuits of my own that I have time for that I didn't before. So I feel grateful for that.
I think that when we were able to perform for so long, I'm sure a lot of performing artists just really had to think what's really important to you and what do you want to be doing, or when you're able to perform again, what's going to be the most important thing. Did it help you reassess your priorities more than just eliminating teaching in terms of the kind of projects you want to do?
Oh, excellent question. Yes. And I think in terms of what I want to be doing and what I don't want to be doing,
Yeah.
and letting go of some things that just don't fit anymore, and having, in a way, like permission to do it, because the grand pause, as my friend George Kohler calls it, the grand pause of COVID. And chance to reset, and I have. And one of the other things that I was able to do is it was really good for me for working on technique on my flute and my clarinet, and not being good at just playing this 60 bar 64 to 68 of this piece and blah, and this element or this show, subbing into a show or something, and I know this much music. So I really went back to basic flute and clarinet daily work, and it's been fantastic. I love the flute and the clarinet. And my clarinet, her name is Hillary, and she's complicated but beautiful. And it's like they require, they deserve time to honor the sound and the technique of the instrument, so that was another good thing for me to have time to do that.
This is a big ask, but I mean, would you be willing to play either your flute or clarinet?
What do I have? Okay, let me just see. I'll grab my flute. Okay, just have to keep in mind that I just got back from Kamloops and I haven't played my flute in a couple of weeks because I was out there helping my mom. So let's see what happens. Hey, remember me? We were talking about playing together. All right, I'll play a little jazz flute. Little Mo Kaufman for you. Honestly, I've been working on getting a more legit tone, but that's my 1970s disco flute sound without doing a good warm up.
Did you hear him live back in the day?
I did. In fact, Manteca, you'll talk to Matt about this when you talk to Matt, just finished doing a project called the Offspring Project.
Okay.
And Mo Kaufman's grandson, Jake Kaufman, played with us and played a
Okay.
few tunes with us. And he is now doing a Mo Kaufman, Bernie Sinensky, who played with Mo, pianist, great jazz pianist, who played with Mo as it's a Mo Kaufman tribute show. And Jake is playing flute and clarinet in that, and he sounds fantastic. So yes, of course, I did go and see Mo and the cats, all the cats. And they got, you know what, they were such great musicians and they were working all the time and in the studio all day, and then they were playing at George's Spaghetti House at night, and it was a very rich time for music in Toronto for sure at that time.
Yeah. And there was so much more radio opportunities, I think, and
Yeah.
nice to,
Variety shows.
yeah.
CBC variety shows and radio programming, and composition, just recording commercials in the studio constantly. And then the Boss Brass, of course. Mo was the lead alto player in the band, and just stunning virtuosity.
One thing I ran across is that you had collaborated a little bit with Oliver Schroer.
Do you know Oliver? Did you know him?
I think one of the first dates I went on with my husband was to go hear him live in Ottawa, and it was really memorable. And then, he got sick, and it was so sad. But we had a few of his recordings.
So I played in the Stewed Tomatoes, and I met him through folk circles. I work with a vocalist, songwriter, composer, singer, David Sarita, and I think I met Oliver playing with him at a festival. And Oliver was and continues to be a remarkable musician and human being, and very influential mentor to other fiddle players. He started a project in Smithers, BC. He moved out there and he started a project called the Twisted String. And probably about 25 young musicians came out of that, and they continue to be in working. And it just the kind of love and training and learning by ear, teaching by rote, this really complex music, but from this place of love and generosity. Oliver was a remarkable human, and I always thought of him, he was sort of like the sun. Everything kind of revolves around Oliver. He was had a great capacity for prolific composer, and really left of center in terms of the instrument. I think in terms of the violin, the fiddle, has solo recordings. He walked the Camino Trail and stopped in every church along the way and recorded himself playing. I mean, it's just profound. And I treasure my experiences getting to play with him. Very special.
I think I remember reading for that. I think I have that recording that he didn't want the weight of a case, so he had his violin wrapped in a cloth or something for that track.
I know. It was. It. I mean, to take it in, just to be able to actually do that track and the kind of mind and body state that you have to be in to be able to do it, and then, but to think to bring your violin and whatever, however he recorded it, was a very Oliver thing to do.
And I wanted to ask you about your association with Soul Pepper Theater. What kind of work did you do with them?
So I worked with them as a musician for hire several times, and then I was a resident artist with them for about 5 years. And in that capacity, we were tasked with throwing ideas out. We ended up doing some cabaret programming, and eventually, through the work that they were doing as a collective, came up with this really great music th and theater concept for shows. Like, it's music with theater, so music, story, contextualizing, dramatizing, and integrating with music. Really, really cool. I know there's other companies that are doing that now, because it's just so interesting. So it involved either music directing, playing in a band, and creating ideas around what kinds of how we can integrate music more into, and then some mentoring. I did work with some of the students doing music specific stuff as well. Yeah, I love that. Was a that was and I, that's where I learned about being a better leader, about taking leadership, and about having it thrust upon one. And rising to the occasion and being entrusted with tasked with a lot of creative things that I hadn't had the opportunity to explore that side of my work. And they trusted me with with things. I learned a lot, and feel like I contributed too. It was great, wonderful.
We started this conversation talking about mentorship, and to close out, I was just thinking, back when you're in Gloucester High School, Could you have pictured the kind of interesting diversity you've had in your career so far? Like what that would have looked like? Would that have been in your consciousness, the possibilities?
That's a good question. I don't know if I had that level of self-awareness at that time. I was pretty freaked out most of the time. I see, like I say, I have a 24-year-old daughter. Her friends and all of my younger colleagues, I mean, they just seem to be so much more together than I ever was. I just spent most of my time going, "What the?" I was in one, I really was in the moment. I think what I do remember when I felt like my direction was affirmed, like I might be in going in the right direction, I had some moments where I felt like I was going to explode if I didn't get to play a certain thing that I heard, or I felt like so much desire, like a craving that, oh, I don't know what it is about this piece of music, but I have to play it or I have to listen to it 100 times and to try and understand what, like, I remember having those feelings in terms of me being able to, I don't know what it looked like. I just know what it felt like on the inside. I had no concept of how I would do that in any larger picture. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but.
That brings me back, to my, student days too. That longing, certain music that you just fell in love with. And, but it's funny. One of my daughters is also 24 and is in a different field, but a creative field. And I see like just their education and the way they think about themselves is very different. I think they're really encouraged to think about their goals in a practical way. And the whole idea of mentorship is something that's actually talked about and entrepreneurial spirit, which you need in any kind of creative work, I think.
Isn't that fantastic? That's what's supposed to happen. That's evolution. We're supposed to improve upon. And plus, I think too, obviously I probably have lots of friends who have kids and they've grown up with parents who are musicians or in creative fields. And I think that there's a certain skill set that comes from watching your parents strive. We're in a striving career and there's no arriving. It's a striving. And my daughter too, she's really involved in music and has a lot of friends, or she's a singer-songwriter, but her career is very different than that at this point anyway. And I feel like that feels successful too. It's she's choosing to have music be a significant part of her life, but not necessarily how she generates income. And that feels fantastic for now.
Well, one thing that keeps coming up as I talk to more and more musicians is what does it mean to be a musician or quote professional musician? It means a lot of things, right?
It does. It's a large, honorable. It's a skill set and an honorable career. And it's fraught. There's lots of challenges. But at the end of the day, we're doing something that we are deeply invested in, and that feels meaningful. It's a meaning. It's a life full of meaning. Ups and downs.
Well, thanks so much, Colleen, for sharing your perspectives and your music today. I really appreciated it.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you for having me. And your questions are just deep and well thought. And I appreciate you looking into things that I've done. I feel honored that you took the time to do that. Thank you.
Course.
I
so enjoyed learning about Colleen's varied career and music making and loved hearing about her approaches to creativity as well as staying centered and healthy. Thanks for following this series. Please share this episode with your friends. Have a great week.